Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. If you could live anywhere, what place would you choose? What would play into your decision? In addition to thinking about climate, culture, and cost, my guest today would argue you ought to think about where you are in your personal life. Depending on whether you are gay or straight, dating, married to your career, married with kids, or an empty nester, the things you want out of your hometown are likely to be very different. And making the right choice about where to live could have a huge impact on how happy you feel most of the time. Richard Florida is professor of business and creativity at the University of Toronto, where he also serves as director of the Martin Prosperity Institute. His latest book is called Who's Your City? How the Creative Economy is Making Where to Live the Most Important Decision of Your Life. Rich, welcome to Think.
Oh, it's so good to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
So we all give thought from the time we're little kids to choosing a career, ultimately to choosing a mate. You think the decision about where we're going to live deserves equal consideration, and yet we just sort of fall into that many times.
Well, you know, one of the things we found out in doing the research for this book, Who's Your City, is that 40 million Americans move every year. And about 15 million of us make a big move. We move to a new city, we move to a new state, or about less than 1% of us, but a significant amount move actually to out of the country. And you know, people give a lot of thought to their job and career, and people give a lot of thought, and we have lots of advice on relationships. But what I found after, you know, studying this kind of places and urbanism and location and geography for more than 20 years is that very few of us give serious thought, you know, or even have the tools to give serious thought to the place we live. And the way I like to say it sometimes is, you know, most people actually pay more attention to buying a car. You know, they look at the brands and the models they like, they search the websites, they go to the dealer, they shop around, they take cars for a test drive. And when you really think about it, people make moves intuitively. You know, they move for a new job, they got a transfer, they think it'll be better somewhere else, they met a boy or a girl. Oh, you know, I need a better school system for my kids. And they don't do much systematic study, they just do it. So what the book is saying is this decision is so darn important to your life, to your career, to your love life, to your family life, to your lifestyle, to actually the way your investments are going to pan out, because a house is the biggest investment you'll make, that we need to give it more serious thought. And the book tries to help people make that decision in a more informed way.
Really interesting to me that moving seems to be a phenomenon very much of the young. Can you talk about that?
Well, you know, clearly in the book I say there are three big moves in your life. And if you really want to get down to brass tacks, the first one of those is when you're young. And typically, not exclusively, but typically it's the after college move. And, you know, preponderance of movers are in their 20s. And, in fact, people are most likely to move when they're kind of 24 or 25. But the second big move you make is when you're kids, not when you get married, but when you have kids. And then the third big move you're likely to make is when the kids leave the house and you're an empty nester. But going back to your point about the young, you know, young people are anywhere from about 5 to 6 times, anywhere 3 times more likely than other groups to move. But the thing is that I believe, the research substantiates, that first move is so darn important to your life. And the way I'd say this to folks listening in, and people graduating college or coming out of graduate school, or to moms and dads listening in, is you know how much attention we pay to our kids or for a young person getting into the right college and all that pressure about filling out the application forms and going on visits and making sure the college fits us or finding that right graduate program? In fact, as important or more important than that is where we move after college. And one of the things that I really worry about is so many moms and dads and kids telling me, well, I'm going to move back home after college to save money. Wrong. After you've made that huge investment in education, what's going to really move a career forward or help people figure out what career they want to do is where they choose to live. And in fact, it's likely to have a bigger effect on your life than where you chose to go to school. So one of the things I really oriented this book to is for young people and moms and dads to think about that location decision after college is as important, if not more important, than the decision of where to go to college, which you made with great attention. You need to give that even more attention, not just say, I'm going to move home and try to figure it out. Where that move is after college is going to set your career trajectory. It's going to build your networks. It's going to give you the contact mix you need, you know, because most young people under 30 change jobs on average every year. It's going to put you in a labor market. And most importantly, I think, if you're looking to meet that special someone, or you're looking to make friends who are interesting, where you live is going to have a huge effect on the potential mates. You know, in the book I say it's not just the mating, the labor market, it's the mating market that matters. But not just for boys and girls, or, you know, for this partner, life partner, also for just meeting people who are going to be important to your life and career. And the book goes on to say that it really depends on what field you're going to enter. The city you choose, if you're career-oriented, or the place you choose, has a lot to do with the kind of field you're going to enter, and make that choice knowingly. You know, make that choice for yourself. Don't let it just happen to you.
So in other words, there are some careers that are really centralized in a particular geographic region. There are others that you can do anywhere as long as you're in a particular size city, something like that.
Yeah, I think what's happened and what we document in the book is, you know, even though people have prognosticated that, you know, distance is no longer mattering, that place is no longer important, that we can telecommute, the virtual world, the internet. In fact, people, economics, companies, and opportunities are concentrating. And, you know, one of the things, I gave a copy of the draft of the book to a friend in Washington, D.C., at a think tank, Will Wilkinson, and he wrote back a great comment, and he said, you really need to write this book, Rich, because there's, you know, people who think they want to be in, you know, acting or filmmaking or theater, but they don't want to move to New York or L.A. And he wrote back, well, then those people have to realize they're going to have to suck it up and do dinner theater in Biloxi. You know, har, har, har. But the point is that in many fields, whether it's software industry in Silicon Valley or, you know, the entertainment industry in Hollywood or the music industry in Nashville, which is one we talk about, or investment banking in New York, or, you know, or the oil and oil-related industries in Houston. In many and increasing industries, economic opportunity, for reasons I talk about in the book, is becoming very concentrated. So that increasingly, if you want to achieve the top in your field, your locational choices are not everywhere. They may be a several specific places. And you just need to be conscious of that if you're going to pick one of those careers, you may have to move if you want to reach the pinnacle of that career.
Yeah, and you point out, which I think is very interesting and worthy of noting, that not everybody, although we're all sort of told that we're supposed to want to be the very best in the entire world at what we do, not everyone really has ambitions that center solely on career.
Well, you know, that's what the book really says. You have a set of trade-offs to make in making this decision. And it really wants to help people kind of think about and be aware of those trade-offs. One is location, where you choose to live is going to have a big effect on your job and career, no doubt. But I talk in the book about how I moved 17 times since I left graduate school, and how I grew up in a large Italian-American extended family in northern New Jersey, and I moved all over the country, and now we live in Toronto. And when my wife and I got married, my wife is Jordanian, she comes from the Detroit area, she left a large extended Jordanian family. Well, I talked about this tension between being mobile for economic opportunity and being rooted close to family and friends and what, you know, Robert Putnam at Harvard calls this enormous kind of thing of social capital, repository of social capital. And I actually talk about the research of an economist, a British economist, who's estimated how much it actually costs you in terms of psychic income when you leave behind family and friends. And he says a minimum, and most people think this is too low, a minimum of $130,000. So I make this kind of offhand joke in the book that I must owe my wife a lot of money because she married me and moved for this reason. But with regard to lifestyle, you know, if you want to do certain lifestyle pursuits, if I'm a cyclist and that really matters to you, or you like to windsail or windsurf, or you like to ski, these are also self-evident things. And there are certain people who like urban amenities, nightlife and theater and movies, other people who like natural amenities, outdoorsy things. And then finally, I also talk about your personality. Certain kinds of personalities, and the book talks about these, are better suited in certain kinds of environments. So you need to think about all those trade-offs. You know, how much do I want to move for career? How much do I want to stay around family and friends? How much do my lifestyle interests matter to me? Am I single? Am I married? Am I an empty nester? Do I have kids? And you need to give those weight. And we have a thing on the website at whosyourcity.com. We built a tool called the Place Finder. And we say to people, give it a go. You know, it's 10 questions. It's easy to do. But once you take it and look at the book, it'll help you evaluate the places, not just cities, the suburbs, the rural areas, the villages, that may be more or less well-suited for you.
Richard Florida is my guest. His new book is called Who's Your City? How the Creative Economy is Making Where to Live the Most Important Decision of Your Life. I looked on your map and you've identified North Texas as a place where the dominant culture is open to new experiences. What does that mean for the way we live?
Well, that's a really good thing in my book, probably because I'm an open to experience person. There are five personality types, according to psychologists, and we partnered with this brilliant young psychologist who was educated at the University of Texas, and his professor is still there, Sam Gosling. This young man's name is Jason Renfro. And what Jason and his research and Sam's research and other psychologists show, there are five personality types. There are agreeable people. They work well in teams. They get along with others. There's conscientious people. They're very dutiful. They do things. They meet their demands and expectations. There's extroverts, people who like to be around other people. There's neurotic people. We all know who those are. And then there's this group of people called open to experience. Open to experience people are very open to new experiences. They want to be constantly stimulated. They're also the kinds of people who tend to go into the arts, the creative fields. They're highly innovative. They're technologists. They're entrepreneurs. They're kind of sometimes a little bit aloof, a little bit disagreeable, very focused inwardly in themselves. Well, what we found in doing this research is that personality types cluster. But if the agreeable people and the conscientious people kind of cluster in the Sun Belt broadly or the Midwest, the open to experience people, because they're very innovative and creative, they like to move around and migrate, are very pocketed. They're in New York. They're in Boston. They're in Washington. There's a little cluster in Miami. They're in Seattle. They're in San Francisco. They're in LA. But they're also in North Texas. And what we found in our research is that where these pockets of open to experience people are, you also tend to get higher rates of innovation and discovery and creativity in high-tech entrepreneurial industries. So the good thing for North Texas is that it's one of these centers, and in your part of the world, uniquely one of these centers in your region of the world, and in some ways comparable to a New York or a Boston or a San Francisco or a Seattle. So that's to our mind, quite an advantage and a very interesting one for your region.
And one of the only ones that can sort of be influenced by things like government policy and business innovation. The others are sort of naturally what they are and don't change much.
Yeah, we think what happens actually is that open to experience people are very risk-taking and they want stimulation. So what happens is they're not conscious of this or aware of this. They're kind of seeking out places where they can be themselves. They're seeking out places where they'll be welcomed. And so over time, they kind of find each other. So whether that's in the West Village in New York, 50 years ago, or whether it's in the greater Austin corridor and down all over to Dallas, in our time, or San Francisco or something, they kind of converge on one another. When they find an environment where they can be themselves and gain these experiences, they kind of last there. So I think government policy plays a role, but it's really something that happens bottom up and organically over time. But once you have a cluster of open to experience people, in terms of innovation and creativity and discovery and economics, it gives you a terrific edge.
And I was also interested to discover that there are a lot more single men in Dallas than single women.
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing that's really caught a lot of attention about the book, which I found to be quite interesting. National Geographic originally made a map called the Singles Map. And in the book, I updated that map and expanded the definition and collected new data. This is the thing that gets people really excited about the book. And what we found is that in general on the East Coast of America, like New York, Washington, Boston, there are considerably more single women than men. And in generally on the West Coast, in the west of the country, there are more single men than women. So we kind of said that, if you're a man looking for a woman looking for a man, your ratios are better in certain cities. And Dallas has its own. I just wonder if people agree. One of the things we've heard that's so funny, Chris, is people said, well, you might have talked about quantity. And I'm telling you, I've got hundreds of emails about this, but you haven't controlled for quality. And I get this all the time. And the other one.
Richard, hold on 1 second because we've got to take a break. I want to get the rest of this because I'm sure people are interested. Richard Florida is my guest. His book is called Who's Your City? Our number is 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, creativity and curiosity, sharp. Details online at smu.edu/MLS.
You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is the director of the Martin Prosperity Institute and a professor of business and creativity at the University of Toronto, Richard Florida. His new book is called Who's Your City? How the Creative Economy is Making Where to Live the Most Important Decision of Your Life. You can join our conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Well, Richard, you talked about people sort of sending you emails about quantity versus quality. And I guess in some cases, it's kind of a serious thing in that people want education levels to sort of be in line, and there may be reasons why people stay single.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that came back I was saying is the fact that so many people wanted to know if it was throwing off the odds in their neighborhood or their city was gay and lesbian people. And I was just, I was rolling on the floor for folks listening in that people think, you know, well, the reason I can't meet somebody in San Francisco is because there's a lot of gay men attracted to one another. So I just thought that was the most humorous thing. I think the thing about the singles ratio is it really does matter. You know, I mean, you can't control for all these things, but if you're in a city like New York, which has, you know, 210,000 more women, single women than men, or in LA that has 110,000 more single men than women, it's not going to affect everyone, but it does have some effect on the dating market. And clearly what we're finding in our research and research of other leading demographers that we consume is that, you know, a declining share of us are now married. And one of the things I find so amazing in my work is how many cities and communities say, we have to attract married people with families. And that's cool. I'm a married person, and I love being married. But there was a long time that I was single. And what we're finding is that people are postponing marriage into their late 20s, and if they're more highly educated people, well into their 30s or beyond. And then, as the book points out, many people, when we have a high rate of divorce, are quote-unquote, I'm making air quotes for folks listening in, are re-singled, you know, and they're back on the market. So it's a very important demographic group that's ignored in a lot of analysis. And what's happening is that single people are flocking to more urbanized areas, to bigger cities, to more energetic areas, simply because there's more to do and there's more people to meet. And in our Gallup survey that we did, one of the key findings of that survey was in evaluating your satisfaction with a community, single or married, the ability to meet people and make friends was really, really high on the list, along with having a very natural and green, open space kind of environment. So this ability to be in an environment, if you're single, for sure, but also even if you're not, where you can meet people. And then finally, you know, if you're living in a place that doesn't have a lot of single people, and Lord knows your relationship breaks up or your marriage breaks up, then we found a lot of people are just feeling desperate because they're living in a place that was fine when they were married. But I say in the book, you know, sometimes it's best to hedge your bets, to pick locations which offer you lots of options both for your career. And I'm not wishing anyone's relationship breakups, but they do break up, and for your life.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. One of the things I think that's really interesting that you did in the book, Rich, is that you also include the best cities for people who are gay or lesbian and raising families. And that's a demographic that often gets ignored in things like this. But there are more and more people of the same sex who are raising kids together. And those cities that are best for them may be very different from the ones best for heterosexual married couples.
You know, this is a very complex question, and I got into it because when I wrote my previous book, Rise of the Creative Class, I met a young fellow named Gary Gates. Gary is now at UCLA. We were both at Carnegie Mellon at the time, and Gary, with some collaborators, had invented this thing he called the Gay Index, and this was before we had census data on where gay and lesbian people live. But anyway, Gary asked me one day, you know, give me your list of your high-tech important cities. And I said, they're, you know, New York, San Francisco, Boston, Seattle, San Diego, something like that. I'll probably add it Austin, Texas, and listen, you've named like 5 of the 10 gayest cities in America. Well, we went on to do research that was reported in Rise of the Creative Class, which showed that cities with a large concentration of gay and lesbian people also tended to have the sort of characteristics that attracted innovative, entrepreneurial, energetic people and had higher rates of innovation and high-tech industry location. Anyway, so in this book, I got lambasted for that. You know, people called me all sorts of names. They said I had a gay agenda. They said, you know, I was out to undermine American civilization. I had an anti-family crusade going on. And I said to myself, the heck with them. I mean, this is very important. I've seen the kind of terrible reaction the gay and lesbian community get I'm going to not only rate cities for families and for heterosexual singles, I'm going to rate every class of cities for gay and lesbian singles, for gay and lesbian families, for gay and lesbian empty nesters. And so we did it. And one thing that's quite clear from Gary's research, that Gary Gates' research, is that there are a lot of gay and lesbian families. And yes, in the past, they have been more concentrated in certain metropolitan areas, San Francisco, New York, you know, Boston, and the others. But now, according to Gary's research, and I want to point this out, that the gay and lesbian families and gay and lesbian households are becoming much more a part of the fabric of American society, and they're much more distributed across all of our communities. So, yes, there's still concentration, but certainly we're finding that there are more places, more and more places where gay and lesbian families can locate and thrive. They may not be every place, but more than there were before.
Richard, Florida is my guest. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak to Amanda in Fort Worth. Hi, Amanda.
Hi. I just wanted to point out something I thought was ironic when you referred to people who are open to experience being aloof and disagreeable. I know that's a generalization, but my question is, in that vein, do they tend to trade off relationships for new experiences?
The short answer is yes. And, I think one of the things that we've always thought is these artistic and innovative people, open to experience people, like to be in artistic scenes. They thrive around one another. They like to be in high technology industries with teams. No, they tend to be kind of lonely. And you know, it's the extroverts that get the charge from being around other people. I don't want to generalize too much, but one of the things I think you're absolutely right about is the open to experience people put a little bit more value, or maybe perhaps much more value, on new experiences, new career accomplishments, new exciting activities, even risky activities, at the expense of tighter relationships. So when people like Robert Putnam talk about the decay of social capital in certain kinds of communities, I think he's absolutely right. But part of it is that these open-to-experience people value or trade off relationships in favor of these new experiences. And that makes for an interesting dynamic, that some of the most innovative and entrepreneurial places are also have the lowest levels of trust, the lowest levels of social capital, and maybe, and I haven't looked at this, but it's a great question, maybe more fractured relationships as a result.
I was really interested by the Csikszentmihalyi research that you quoted that talked about creative energy being tied to curiosity and how that sort of clusters all together.
Wow, I'm amazed that you pronounced his name.
I'm right. A big fan of him, actually.
So am I, and I've met him, and I just call him Mihaly. I mean, Csikszentmihalyi, you said it right, and every time I try to do it on my own, I stumble. Well, this guy, he's so brilliant, and you know, he invented this theory through his studies of flow, the fact that creative people get into this state. And what Mihaly said was, or Mike is how he's called when people want to anglicize his name, what Mike or Mihaly said to me, he said, well, Richard, this is quite not only a state of concentration and productivity, but it's quite pleasurable. And he said, you know, that's why you and I do research and we write. And it was very interesting. He said, it's not only that we're being productive, we actually get great joy. And you know, Mike's now older. He said, I'll never give up doing research. So I asked him, I said, how could we really find out, because I've done this research on creative people, what Mike, would I ask if I really wanted to know if someone was creative? Well, he said, you just ask them how curious they are. And if you find a curious person, a person who's continuously curious, you've probably found a creative personality. And what we found, we actually got data from Mike's collaborators, Marty Seligman, who's also a brilliant positive psychologist at Penn, and Chris Peterson, a positive psychologist at the University of Michigan. They collected data on what they call a values inventory assessment. And anyway, we found that this dimension of curiosity, where you found personalities high in curiosity, you also found that there were higher rates of entrepreneurship and higher rates of innovation. So we found some fairly robust, you know, kind of, not to be too wonky about it, statistical result. Those areas that had people who were scoring high in curiosity, as well as, according to the other research, high and open to experience, boy, oh boy, they seem like they got an additional economic boost.
How is this not a problem, Rich? The fact that most people consider diversity to be a really positive thing in a community, but you know, like attracts like. How do we keep one from invading the other?
Well, you know, this has been a great year for your listening area. and I noted before this fellow, Sam Gosling, who wrote this book. And I just got my copy in the mail called Snoop. And it's all about the psychology of these elements and how you can think about people's personality. He's at the University of Texas at Austin. You had another great book from an Austinite, Bill Bishop. My collaborator and colleague wrote a magnificent book called The Big Sort. And the big central argument of The Big Sort is that what's happening in America today is that people are sorting themselves by education level, not necessarily by ethnicity and race, although that is still happening to some degree, but by education level, by ideological outlook, by the kinds of work they do. And in a sense, just going back to your rubric, that we are becoming more like with like than ever before. You know, when I grew up in Newark, New Jersey, and even in my working class suburb, this perfect example. My whole extended family lived in Newark, but when we moved to North Arlington, this is kind of in the heart of Sopranos country, my dad with an eighth grade education, okay, were factory worker, lived right next door, my mom and her sister, two sisters. My Uncle Walt put himself through night school. He became a master's degree in chemical engineer. He ran all of research for Colgate-Palmolive. So here were two neighbors, working man and high executive, international global executive, living side by side and sharing every day, and that's how our neighborhood was. Now the odds of that happening are next to zero. So we are like versus like. We are more segmented. We are also segmented by life stage. You know, one of the troubling facts about our cities is that our cities now have a Back to the City movement, but the Back to the City movement is young people, gays and lesbians and empty nesters. There's very few families with children. The families with children are all in the suburbs. So I think this is very troubling, and certainly I don't want to go on about just the virtues of Toronto. Toronto, where I live now, is a much more diverse, less segmented community, families, ethnicity. So I think we're really sacrificing something, and I think we have to really think long and hard about this. And certainly in my case, I've chosen always to be in diverse neighborhoods and to avoid this kind of segmentation, but I think it's something that faces our country, and I think it's reflected in our politics. I think it's reflected in this current, in the primary campaign, in the election we're in today.
You did find this part of the country to be sort of a best buy for families with small children. Can you talk about why?
Well, isn't that great? I mean, you should be so proud of that. you know, it was interesting, the cities that came out as good for families with children, because it wasn't just the typical list of places. It was a Washington, D.C. metro area, or a New York, or a San Francisco, or a Boston. But we wanted to get the value deals. We didn't want to get just the places that you could do well with a family, and not just in the city. This is the whole metro area, including the suburbs. And so your area, the Dallas-Austin area, came out to be quite a terrific buy for families with children. And I think that's great. I mean, I think that's just a wonderful thing. The other thing that we know is that you're one of these 40 mega regions. You know, I gave it a name for folks listening in. I called it Dawson. Don't you think that's a cool name? Boston. We came, you know, Boswash for the Boston, New York, Washington corridor. Ambrustwerp for Amsterdam, Brussels, and Antwerp. And New Orleans for Houston and New Orleans. But you got Boston.
And what's really interesting, I should say, you're Tor Buffchester. Is that what I've read?
Yes. Yeah. We here are Tor Buffchester. And we're quite proud of that. And what's interesting about this, folks, and I know you have football fans, what's so interesting is after I coined that lovely name, the Buffalo Bills have decided to play some subset of their games in Toronto. So we like have the first bi-national mega-region football team, but that's neither here nor there. The point is that there are 40 of these mega-regions that are the growth centers and the power centers of the world economy. And these 40 mega-regions account for about two-thirds of world economic output and 9 in 10 innovations and Dallas-Austin corridor. Now, some Texans have written in and said they don't like my characterization because they actually think they call it the Texas Triangle, which is Dallas, San Antonio, Houston, Austin. Our research suggests that they're two separate ones. The Houston one, the Dallas-Austin one is separate, but we are confident that over time they could become one. But they're quite significant economic players. And what's interesting is that in one state, you have two of these kind of economic mega-regions that are really world centers of economic output and innovation. So not only great for families, but you're in a real center of mega-region activity.
Richard Florida is my guest. His new book is called Who's Your City? Our number is 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Eric in Dallas. Hey, Eric.
Hi. I don't know if you can answer this question, but does he think that people with certain personality traits, like you said, like number five, should they search out mates of the same type, or does that matter?
Boy, that's a great question. I think we do. I can't be completely 100% certain of that. We'd have to ask Sam if he's listening in, or Jason over in Cambridge, England, that, because they're psychologists. But I think the reason I would say that, especially for open to experience people, is that these personality types are clustered tightly geographically together. So if they're finding each other in a geographical space, if you will, if they're finding each other in a neighborhood, the likelihood is they're looking for one another. So they're trying to locate near somebody like them. And in that sense, perhaps they're more inclined to marry somebody like them. My hunch is, when it comes to the extrovert is more likely to marry an extrovert. And when it comes to the open to experience is more likely to marry or partner with an open to experience. But I'll tell you, that's a phenomenal, phenomenal question. And we'll be looking into it in greater detail.
But who wants to live with all the neurotics in the Northeast?
The open to experience people.
I was raised in the Northeast.
It's really, really interesting that the neurotics are not only clustered in New York, but they actually go up into a belt into the Northeast and the Frost Belt. And you know, some of that is due with maybe pressures and anxiety and creativity, but you know, part of it may well be due to things like climatic conditions and weather and just grayness. So, but we do find that even the neurotic people are clustered like all the others. And fortunately, less clustered in Toronto, though.
I know that that your research is mostly domestic, but I'm wondering, I guess you assume that this could be applied to most geographic regions all over the world, that there are these five personality types that show up in South America and in Australia and everywhere.
It's interesting. We're working on two subsequent editions of the book. Since I moved to Canada, we're working on a Canadian edition because, well, I live here now and there are people interested. We're also working on a global edition, and the global data is harder to get at, but clearly the same kind of thing is happening around the world. Now, it's clear that Americans are some of the most mobile people in the world. We're very mobile. We attract a lot of foreign-born people. But I think one of the things we could say is that if we look at our migrants, our immigrants are much more likely to be an open-to-experience profile, you know, because they're the most likely to migrate. So in America, in some sense, probably has more of the open-experience types than most places. It's hard to determine, and there's still research to be done on it. But I think also around the world, from the countries that we do have good data, we do find this similar concentration. And I think that what's happening, to be quite candid, is this sorting process is not only going on in the United States. This sorting process by education, by talent level, by outlook, by personality is happening for maybe the first time in human history, not just on a national level, but on a global scale.
Richard Florida is with us. The new book is called Who's Your City? How the Creative Economy is Making Where to Live the Most Important Decision of Your Life. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Back in a minute.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, creativity and curiosity, sharp. Details online at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Richard Florida, whose new book is called Who's Your City? How the Creative Economy is Making Where to Live the Most Important Decision of Your Life. Our phone number is 1-800-933-5372. Rich, in the same way that people can go off and have a vacation and strike up this amazing romance that sort of lasts the length of the vacation and then is over, I wonder if people don't do that. They don't travel to a place on vacation, decide they love it, pick up stakes and move there, only to realize it's not everything they imagined.
I think they do. And behavioral economists who study this say, you know, the grass is greener effect really does occur. We always overestimate and romanticize the next new place until we get there. And one of the things the book says is that you owe it to yourself to really look hard and get beyond the rose-colored glasses with this kind of falling head over heels for a place. And you know, the times you're most likely to do that is when you're really dissatisfied with the place you're living. So maybe the first thing you need to do is when that happens is say, well, maybe I'm not so satisfied with the place I'm living. But instead of just saying, you know, like people bounce, they call it the rebound relationship. I'm not a psychologist, but I know enough about the rebound relationship and how they say it's often not a great choice when you rebound. Well, you know, maybe the rebound place is the same kind of thing. And so people, they need to understand that intuition is telling them something very potent, that they may fit in the place. But they also need to take a good, hard look, because this quick infatuation may be just that. It may not be having all of the things that you need. You know, what I say in the book is there's no best place. There's only the place that best fits you. And so that would be a time that I'd really want somebody to go to the website, HoosierCity.com, do the place finder, and put in a variety of places and calm down. You know, you don't have to move there next week. Calm down and really do an assessment and then spend some considerable time there, in a way, test drive your place and see how it looks a couple of weeks into it before you make this move. Because after you've bought that house and moved all your goods and committed to a new location, you end up miserable. It's a lot harder to undo it. Instead of preventing it in the first place.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Srimi Bossam in Denton. Hi, Srimi Bossam.
Hi. Very interesting topic, and thank you very much. And my question is, your guest was talking about people being open to experience, moving and migrating. My question is, how much of it is the open to experience part and how much of it is necessity? Because a lot of the people, migrants, migrate to the United States, for example, out of necessity. Thank you. I'll hang up and
question.
Listen to it.
Thanks.
This is a really, really, really good question. And I think there is a tremendous amount of necessity migration. But let's take the case of a declining economy like Detroit. In Pittsburgh, where I lived, what tends to happen is that even though there's great necessity to move, the people who are likely to be triggered by that necessity are my grandparents who came from Italy, are people who are very open to experience. The people who are very tightly tied to social relationships, for whom family and relationships mean more than career and economic success. For all these questions, they tend to be later movers are the ones that stay. Because in every place, you have movers and stayers, and I talk about this in the book. So even when there is necessity migration, it seems to me that many, or the preponderance of those people, or maybe the people who are most likely to move first, at least one has to understand that they're more likely to be these open to experience people. And I think the other way to document that is when you look at a place like a Detroit or Cleveland or the Kleining Center, they are filled with dutiful, conscientious, and agreeable people, and they're emptied of open to experience people. So it's suggesting to me that either one of two things happened. Those were places where only dutiful and conscientious and agreeable people were in the first place, which I doubt. Or they're the place where the open to experience people because of necessity left. So I think he's right that necessity plays a role, but with international and domestic migration, I think we're seeing a big, strong role of the open to experience personality being the most likely or the first to migrate.
Well, that also, interestingly, sort of explains some of the re-urbanization that we've seen. You know, everybody left for a while, and now people are starting to go back in and re-experience what it's like to live in a more densely concentrated area.
Well, you know, I've been thinking about this a lot. And in fact, I read a column for the Globe and Mail up here in Toronto, and it's going to be my column on Saturday, so folks can find that on the website if they're interested. Most people have said that this being driven by oil and gas prices. I actually think it's not. And I think the primary driver of this is the time cost of commuting. I think that what's happening in the mega regions is the congestion, the traffic. In the really creative and knowledge-driven, idea-driven economy, the only finite resource is time. So I think that the people who are really successful want to minimize their time faced in commuting. And the other thing we need to realize, it's not happening in every urban area. It's really happening at the maximum level in these big superstar mega regions. And so that for every region that's having this back to the city movement, we're having regions that are seeing not only their center cities decline, but their suburbs decline as well. So there's something big and powerful going on with this back to the city movement. And it's occurring at a global level, but not every city is part of it.
What do you think cities need to do as they're conducting urban planning? Do they need to, obviously they have an obligation to sort of serve everyone, but should they try to attract a particular demographic group and then focus their efforts, or should they try to sort of throw up as much spaghetti on the fridge as will stick?
Well, the great misinterpretation of my book, The Rise of the Creative Class, and partly why I wrote this book, it was because people read that book and they heard the word creative class and said, well, all I need to do is attract the creative class. That's not what that book said. What that book said is that every single human being is creative, and that for cities and regions to thrive, it's a losing game or a zero-sum game to just try to attract the creative class. What you want to do is try to harness the creative energy in more and more and greater segments of your population. If 35% of us work in the creative class, that means 65% of us don't. So I say the really competitive cities and regions will be the ones that activate that creative energy of a much broader segment of the population. But in terms of what cities and regions need to do, I asked the late and great Jane Jacobs this question when she was still alive. And I said, Jane, what could cities and regions do? What could they do to make themselves better, to revitalize? I lived in Pittsburgh at the time. What could Pittsburgh do? And she looked at me, and she gave me this long look, and she said, well, Richard, every place has creative people. Every place has creative energy. The problem that keeps some cities down is they have a group of people in power. She called them the squelchers. They're the people who say, no, it can't be done this way. No, that's not the way we do it here. We don't care for your input. We know what we're doing. We're going to take care of it. The city, the mayor, the task force knows what to do. And I know she's right. So really, I think what cities have to do that want to revitalize is throw out the squelchers. And once the squelchers are gone, then this incredible energy of neighborhood groups, civic groups, immigrants, diverse groups, high tech, whatever, gets focused. And really, the only way you're going to build a city is by having thousands and thousands of people in communities and neighborhoods all working and doing it together, not by having some great leader do it. So I think Jane was right. We have to harness the energy of all the creative people and begin to move the squelchers out of the way. That's really the key thing.
Let's speak next to Bob in Dallas. Hey, Bob.
How are you doing?
Great, thanks.
I had an observation. My parents are retired, and they have migrated during the winters to Florida, Texas, and then also Phoenix area. And I would ask the men, why they would choose one location over the other. And sometimes they would plant themselves in these different areas, and they netted it out as to good ER, emergency rooms, cafeteria food, cheap golf, and in some cases, no bugs. And although that sounds kind of humorous, I was wondering if there's more to it, and if you've had any additional observation on the migration of retirees.
Well, they seem to know what they wanted.
Yeah.
We actually rate the best places for empty nesters and retirees in the book. And we use, well, maybe not cafeteria food, ER cafeteria food, but we use not only the cost of housing, but key is the cost of health care. And the availability of all kinds of what we call, kind of amenities for that age group. And it's very interesting. If we look at empty nesters, the best places are a mix. It's places like San Francisco, Seattle, Boston, Minneapolis, but it's also smaller places like Boulder or Fort Collins, Colorado, Santa Rosa, Texas, Honolulu, Hawaii, and some cold places like Madison, Wisconsin. And then we also did this for retirees. The empty nesters are a little younger. We did this for retirees who were 65 of age and older. We found also there's a mix of some big cities that do very well, San Francisco, New York, and Miami, Honolulu, Hawaii, but also places like Naples, Florida, Santa Barbara, California. And then in the Best Buy category, we actually had places like Pittsburgh and Tampa, Portland, Maine, Allentown, Pennsylvania, Roanoke, Virginia, as well as places like Pensacola, Florida. So we found a mix. But what was interesting is that many of the canonical retirement places, the Phoenixes, the Scottsdales, didn't come up ranked as highly, at least on our measures. That doesn't mean you shouldn't consider them. It meant the way we were looking at it, it seemed to us that there are other places that were equally, if not maybe better suited to empty nesters and retirees. But as I said before, there's no overall best one. We just pointed some examples to get you thinking. There's the one that picks that best fits you.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Richard, Florida, is my guest. And next on the line, we have Joyce in San Antonio. Hey, Joyce.
Hey. My thoughts were a different comment, but you were talking about small cities and mayors and council people. Well, I'm a former mayor of a small city in San Antonio, in the San Antonio area, and what I found was that, and I'm also, I own my own two businesses, and I'm a pretty creative person, but as an elected official, when I wanted to move our city forward, I couldn't do it for exactly the reasons that he said, that I couldn't get them to see the things that I saw that needed to be done for the city to move it forward and to get it out of that that stalemate and to make it acceptable more of a creative, more just, I'm sorry, I'm kind of lost for
words.
Well,
I think I know what you mean, Joyce. You're saying that the squelchers are sort of the ones who got in the way for you.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Was there a gender or age? Can I ask Joyce if there was any pattern she saw with gender, sexual orientation, and age of the group that she had difficulty with?
Yes, age.
What was the age?
When I started out in this, I was about 40, and now I'm 65. And when I started out at 40, the group that I'm talking about was 75 and up.
And they were both heterogeneous with regard to gender, so it was men and women?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
And they had stayed in the same situation all the 30, 40, 50 years they had lived there, and were not inclined to change anything.
Well, let's make sure we have time to get Rich's thoughts. Thank you so much for your call, Joyce.
You're welcome.
When the Australian edition of the book was published, a man I had never met wrote the introduction. He said he met with Australia's leaders, and he explained to them my concepts about technology and innovation. But when he started to talk about the Bohemian and the Gay Index, their eyes just glazed over, and he said, the role of Bohemian arts and culture, gay and lesbian, and economic growth. Their eyes glazed over, and he knew at that moment that this leadership group, which was mainly older white men, would rather see their country decline than do what was necessary to make it an economic powerhouse. And I think that was an eye-opener for me. There are many, many people who've lived in communities for a long time who are so wanting to hold on to their own position of status and leadership that they will squelch exactly what is needed to grow. And I think what's interesting is the places that don't do that, whether that's Chicago or Toronto, and totally remake themselves, are the one that thrives and the one that hold on to those old ways and that old thinking. But what Joyce is up against is not unique. I see it in city after city after city, where everyone kind of knows exactly what needs to be done, but there's tremendous resistance because people just don't want to give up their own power, status, and control. And I think it's tragic. I think because all of those great, the cities have great people and great energy, and they could unhinge it, but the leadership is just so, you know, in a word, and I hate to, it's constipated. And set in their ways that they can't see it through.
I was really interested that you asked Joyce not only about age, but also about gender. Are men and women different?
My own observation as a middle-aged, 50-year-old, straight, white, married white male is that the biggest resistance comes from middle-aged and older white men. And I think it's quite easy to understand. Not only has our workforce become more diverse, there is a big social transformation going on in our society where women have more economic opportunity and more power. Gay and lesbian people have entered the equation. Young people are self-expressing and looking quite different. And I think that's all quite threatening for people who assume that they would be in positions of, I'm making air quotes, power. So I think the reaction of middle-aged white men is quite rational and predictable. What's quite discouraging about it is that it's actually discouraging the kind of positive change we want. My hope is, and as I've written in my books, I think this is all going to pass with time. I think with upcoming generations and the change in our society and our economy, these things will fade from view. But right now, you know, I really would like to accelerate the pace of change. I'm not – the passage of time isn't sufficient for me, nor was it for Joyce. So, you know, and I think what's happening in the meantime are people saying, heck, if you won't change, I'm going to move to a location that I fit in. And therefore, we have growing places and declining places.
Richard Florida's latest book is called Who's Your City? How the Creative Economy is Making Where to Live the Most Important Decision of Your Life. You can find all that information online at whosyourcity.com. Richard, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure, and thanks to all the callers. And if you want to follow along, go to whosyourcity.com, take the place finder, or send me an email at the website. We'd be glad to carry on the conversation. Thanks again for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.